Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. In today's podcast, we welcome Andrew Marchese, Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager of Fidelity Canadian Disciplined Equity Fund, Canadian Equity Private Pool, and Concentrated Canadian Equity Private Pool. Andrew will be discussing the outlook of Canadian and global markets heading into Q4, as well as provide listeners with a closer look into the U.S. election, trade tensions, oil prices, a pending COVID vaccine, and more. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets changes frequently. This podcast was recorded on September 30th, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Andrew, welcome. Great to see you.
Hi, Pamela. Great to be here.
Andrew, I want to sort of get to the concerns and anxieties. I mean, there's a question of whether the fear of coming danger or concern is worse than the danger itself. What do you think?
I think the anxiety on behalf of some investors is what they may perceive to be a disconnect between equity prices, predominantly in the U.S., and the state of the real kind of Main Street economy. Has the market become too disconnected from reality? We know small, medium enterprises are still struggling. While the jobs numbers look better, are they going to plateau? That is some of the questions that people are asking themselves. And I think just wrestling with that, you know, we're up year to date, you know, in the U.S. making new highs. The NASDAQ has been moving up precipitously here all year. Does that feel right? So I think that's really the question where the anxiety really comes from. Without kind of peeling back the onion and doing the deep dive analysis, does it actually feel right to have markets at these levels while there's a lot of uncertainty underpinning all of that in the real kind of Main Street economy? And I think that's where the anxiety lies.
Are we at a point now where, as you say, we've had obviously the fall off and then this drive back upward again? Where do we sit now? What is this moment in the markets, if you will?
I think the market has treated the coronavirus globally as a natural disaster, one that is transient, one that we will push through as a global society, one that it is giving diminishing credence to as being something that we're going to regress from a behavioral perspective. Things may get tougher as we enter the fall and winter seasons, but I think the general perspective of the market is we will push on, we will go on, we will find a way, and we will look into the out years when we return to some form of normalcy to price securities off of a normalized earnings basis. Some businesses will actually come out better from all of this. Some of them may continue to wane. And so when you decompose the market, if you look at the NASDAQ in businesses that are, some are benefiting, not all, but some are benefiting from the state of affairs that we are in as a society. And they may actually get stronger from this point for a lot of fundamental reasons. And then you compare and contrast that with a number of stocks, let's say in the Russell 2000, which is comprised of small and mid-cap businesses, where you rely on a different group of customers and activity, basic activity. And you can see that the returns there have not been as robust. We're off the bottom, but now we're starting to regress as we've kind of come through the summer months in that index So it's really, the market's kind of bifurcated, and it's really trying to pick out the winners and the losers. I think what's really buoyed all of this, though, is I've talked about fundamentals. I would say the majority of the market move has more to do with liquidity, not unlike the various rounds of QE that we saw last decade. Anytime the market got in kind of trouble, when central banks came to the rescue and started stimulating, asset prices moved up. And so I think the move off the bottom is in part a recognizing we've probably seen the worst fundamentally. We are going to go on as a society, and therefore it's more like a natural disaster. But the lion's share of the movement up is aided and abetted by the amount of liquidity in the system, which is really unprecedented.
It is unprecedented, and yet we seem to be somewhat addicted to it. Maybe there's another term for that, but here we are waiting for not central bank stimulus, but fiscal stimulus with almost the same sort of market reaction. Can you put that into perspective for us? Are we sort of just waiting for the next stimulus check?
I think your word addiction does kind of ring true a little bit. It was a word that was used a lot during, you know, QE 1, 2, and 3 last decade. If I look at stock market valuations, and let's take the area of the market that many pundits will point to as being the most overvalued, just to put it into context. So currently, if you take those large cap software predominant names, they're trading at roughly around 12 times EV to sales, which is 2 times higher than they were over a 5-year average, right? And about 2.5 times higher when the market first went down back in 15, 16. So if you take the discount rate down by 2 points, which we've done, you would say that your discounted cash flow would probably be 20% higher. But these stocks are a lot higher than 20% higher. And if you take the fastest growing stocks in that, they are trading at high teens, if not 20 times EV to sales. And then what the market has gotten to is a fundamental look at, are these businesses, I don't want to say bulletproof, but near kind of operating and growing at a level irrespective of the underlying fundamentals of an economy that affect us all broadly. And so you start pricing in kind of you'd have to price in over the next decade, kind of a 7 to 8-fold increase in revenue with probably higher margins, higher durable margins, and better return on invested capital to kind of back in the said valuations. And I'm not going to say that's right or wrong, but that's some of the implication that you're making. So then the question going back to your point is it liquidity, or is the market, based on the fact that you have been pushed out onto the risk curve, willing to look out further in businesses which, as we sit here today, are perceived to be just structurally better, even better than what they were 5 years ago? So the whole aspect of liquidity, I think, has to draw to your, what is a reasonable amount of time to discount future events? And when you're not being paid anything to keep your money in cash and you're pushed out in the risk curve, I think you will take more risk. If you want, some people don't even call it risk, but they'll say, I'm being forced to look out further. And if I'm going to do that, I want to be in businesses which are giving me the greatest likelihood of being at least as structurally good, if not better, in 5 to 10 years time. And that's why I think other aspects of the market, like financials, energy, more traditional value stocks, they're the same businesses. That they have the same pros and cons as they did 5, 10, 20, 50 years ago. And I think that's it. When you lower the discount rate and you flood the system with liquidity, do you take on a longer term horizon implicitly and bear on more risk about future fundamentals? I think that's the question I think we're asking ourselves.
It's so interesting. And I just want to sort of pull in a few things that you mentioned there, because that was fascinating. To an extent, we've got the election looming. We're still in the midst of this pandemic, and we can't really see the future, or we're not sure if the clarity is there to see earnings of that much of rising as much as you just mentioned in terms of some of these stocks. But it sort of doesn't matter because we've got this liquidity sloshing around. Is that sort of it? I mean, the clarity still isn't quite there, right? I mean, these earnings projections are what do you think of them?
Well, I think the clarity isn't there, but what the market historically is very good at is discounting future events. You know, if you just have to go back to not that long ago to the global financial crisis, the market, when everybody was panicking and thought the whole financial system was going to collapse upon itself and seize up, when you did a postmortem on the events that happened after that, actually the market saw through rising earnings through 2011 and 12 and got ahead of it. You don't know that when you're in it, but you can only do that ex post, right? When you look back, and when you look back, it's like the market actually got it right. So the question now is, if this is a natural disaster, it at some point will go away. We don't know when that is or why it will go away, but if there's ever a degree of confidence, and central banks have said we are pinning rates where they are till at least 2023, you will take it upon yourself to then make some, you know, forecasts or estimates about, as I said, with the revenue prognostication for some of these software companies, what that's going to look like, and say, I do think they can grow 7 or 8-fold, you know, revenue over the next 10 years. I do think the margins are durable, if not even better, on a go-forward basis. People are making those assumptions. We'll only know if you're right when you kind of get there, but those are the estimates that people are kind of throwing around. And the other thing, it goes back to when we were last doing this call, I left the call by saying, you got to remember, we've kind of gone through our recession now, and we could debate on how quickly we come out of that and the magnitude by which we come out of it. But as I'm often fond of showing in my Roy Thompson presentations, we're starting a new cycle. So your natural likelihood to look out further should be there. That should be actually a very popular investor behavior, because you have time on your side. Yeah, the market gets ahead of itself sometimes and so on and so forth. But it is a remarkably accurate over long stretches of times discounting mechanism.
So a number of questions starting to roll, and some of them to do with the U.S. election and some of those things. So actually, let's talk about the U.S. election a little bit here. First of all, this specific question from one of the advisors is there a better candidate for Canadian equities, basically, for Canada, for investors looking at Canadian equities?
I don't think so. I think some people might cite the fact that if Biden is elected and there's a Democratic sweep, while that would be negative for U.S. oil, it might actually be positive for more foreign company oil. So you could see an underlying bid under that kind of theme for Canadian oil and gas. I would be hesitant to make that kind of leap, because I think there's other forces, which I've talked about before, on the supply-demand side, but also on the multiple compression side with respect to ESG investing and forced divestiture based on greenhouse gas emissions and carbon footprint in our portfolios, that I think one also has to consider in valuing said securities. In other sectors, I don't know necessarily that one outcome is better than others for Canadian stocks, and I'm certainly not doing anything in my portfolio with respect to trying to prognosticate who will win the election in November.
Let's take this moment to go global a little bit. Sometimes Canada and maybe Canadian oil and energy too are seen as, you say, sort of ex-US, maybe in a more global framework. How do you see global trends affecting Canada? I mean, I'm talking about trade tensions, basically, but how do you see that going forward? Maybe not with or without a certain president, but just they seem to be breaking up into sort of two pieces. How does Canada fit in there?
Yeah, I think one of the fallouts of even the pandemic is that the world is getting smaller, not bigger. it is getting a little bit more insular, and it has to. I think we, you know, it hit the news wire the other day about Canada's population growth slowing because of the pandemic. And again, this is transient, and this will abate at some point, and we'll resume growth, both population growth and economic growth. It may take a while to kind of reestablish thoughts around trade in kind of the new world. I don't know necessarily what those conclusions will be, but I think there will be a resumption of activity and discussion around trying to take the world from where we've been over the last certainly 4 years in the world shrinking and becoming more insular to trying to get the world to think a little bit more globally. The catalyst may be a new president. The catalyst may be, you know, the extinguishing of the virus, and it, you know, promotes new business activity, more global activity. That will, you know, remain to be seen. But again, as it pertains to my portfolios, I'm not making any large kind of top-down prognostications on trade either getting better or worse from this point on.
You know, you said a few months ago, and this was really shortly after the big fall off. I think it was, maybe it was early May, but I'll have to go back and check my notes. But I remember you saying, you know, one day we'll probably look back on this moment, the oil prices, and think that that was a very interesting moment. Do you have any more specifics for us at this moment?
It's when things get as washed out as they did back in March, you kind of, you know, it's been my experience actually having lived kind of somewhat similar scenarios in my career, but also looking back in history, it always kind of, you know, you never know it when you're in it, but you kind of look back on it and say, well, that was a great moment to buy a lot of things. As we sit here today, as I mentioned just earlier, with respect to that, the oil and gas, that is, The fundamentals still don't look great to me on the supply-demand side. I've talked about this. I feel like I've been talking about it for the last 2 years, and I think it's actually accelerating, which, again, is the forced divestiture, particularly by asset managers globally of E&P companies. And what does that do to the valuation metrics of these companies? It you know, I think for the audience out there, they should know that we've always you know, we backtest a lot of factors about, are they predictive of future stock returns? And so going back to the comments in March about, we might look back and say this is a once in a kind of lifetime buying opportunity for this sector. And I do know people in the industry feel very, very bullish about oil and gas as an investment. But one thing that we've done in Fidelity, we've backtested valuation of oil and gas stocks as a predictor of future performance. And I can tell you, it's actually quite a poor predictor of future performance. In other words, cheap oil and gas stocks, generally speaking, as a collection of stocks, don't make good investments. You do need strong fundamental improvement in both supply and demand as being the primary drivers of stock returns. So I think, you know, for anybody who has personal investments in the oil and gas industry, and or you know, for fund managers in Fidelity, we talk about this all the time. If the only bullet point in your investment thesis is that it's cheap, you should probably look for at least two or three other bullet points to support the buy thesis, because historically, it's not a great predictor of future stock returns.
So you talk about that all the time with fund managers, as you said. Are there other great debates that go on between you, the fund managers? I'm assuming you all meet on Zoom probably for these conversations now. The question coming in here is about inflation, particularly in Canada. How does Canada get out of debt? Does it inflate its way out? Where does that conversation sit right now? Can you divvy? You don't have to name names, but is there like a percentage of fund managers who are looking at it as a real threat, inflation, and how is that seen?
Inflation is probably the most topical point of debate within people in the Canadian team, and also people that I've had conversations with who are part of our fixed income team and multi-asset teams who reside in London or Hong Kong and Singapore. And I think it's pretty bifurcated. I think the general theme is, with the amount of stimulus and money rolling around in the system, eventually this has to lead to inflation. That being said, a lot of us made that same commentary back in 2008 and 2009. And as we know, inflation never showed up. For those who've heard me talk before, I think even for those who are on the inflationary side, there is some debate about whether we're going to see it over the next 5 years. I think it's pretty bifurcated on that front, in the sense that even for those who are in the inflationary camp, half of them think it's going to be more of a post 2025 event. The other half would say, no, it's going to show up over the next year or two. I tend to be more in the former camp. I think there's still a lot of disinflationary forces that exist that will push back on the amount of stimulus in the system. Again, for those of you who have heard me speak before, I've talked about technology is definitely disinflationary. The age wave globally and the amount of people actually leaving the workforce is disinflationary. The amount of debt in the system globally is disinflationary over short periods of time. But going back to the conundrum that we faced in 2008, how do you get rid of the debt? Do you grow your way out of it, or do you inflate your way out of it? The growth argument gets really, really challenged without meaningful, and I wouldn't stress the word meaningful enough, innovation in how we live to ramp up our productivity in an exponential fashion.
Heard of innovation that you can point to?
At this time, no. I mean, we're innovating every day, and some would argue that we're living in the most innovative time that man has ever lived through in history. But in terms of taking monumental leaps forward in productivity, it's not showing up in the data, at least yet. So that leaves us with inflation. You have to inflate away the debt. So my personal belief is, and this is why central banks will always err on the side of inflation, where they've come out and said, we're not doing anything till 2023. We're not even going to think about doing anything for 3 years. They have to say that. In fact, moreover, they have to do that. My thought is to try to err on the side of getting inflation started and kind of righting the problems of about 40 years worth of disinflation, right? We've experienced 40 plus years of disinflation. So that remains to be seen, but it is probably the topic that is most debated amongst the investment professionals that I interact with on a day in and day out basis.
Your university background was in pharmacology, and I believe also family business within that. We've spoken to you before about how you look at the medical landscape right now. This question of distribution of a vaccine and other sort of testing related things, do you have any observations that you can share with us?
I think there's probably a little bit too much anxiety about if a vaccine proves to be effective and approved for use and how we disseminate it to the world and the proper distribution channels and manufacturing. Do we have enough manufacturing capacity and whatnot? I think that stuff all gets resolved over time. I think it's natural to, again, for those who have heard me speak before, I think sometimes the media can garner more clicks and eyeballs if you scare people and make people worried about things than you can by just trying to take a more moderate approach. I'm of the belief that manufacturing capacity will show up. It will happen. We'll figure out how to distribute it. What we got to figure out right now is actually getting it through the FDA, right? And finding something that actually works. That's problem one. And you can't rush that. And you know, it's just good science. And hopefully we get good science. But the rest of it will kind of, it will figure itself out. You know, I think one thing that's for the viewers out there, which some may know, some may not know. The pharmaceutical industry for decades has had to think about distribution of various drugs en masse, or maybe in small numbers in very difficult parts of the world. And so logistical issues and manufacturing issues are far more prevalent than what people may believe. And I think because of that institutional knowledge that pharmaceutical companies do have, and in working with government accordingly, I think you get a reasonable outcome if and when we get a vaccine that is approved by drug authorities.
So we sort of have to have some version of patience and perhaps a little faith. Is that also the situation with markets? Because we do seem to be, you know, in volatile times. There's no question.
Yeah, you know, I think I tend to be very moderate in my approach to investing, and I tend to be very moderate in my approach to kind of dealing with highs and lows and in the world, like from a news flow perspective. And so I think sometimes, you know, when things are really bad, I don't really tend to think they're as bad as what people, the rest of the world or consensus thinks they are. Similarly, when things are really good, I tend to, you know, kind of take half the water out of the glass. And I think that served me well over 22 years. I think you can see by the performance of Discipline Equity and some of my other portfolios, you kind of get more consistent, less outsized big and down years. It's just, you kind of just, it's more of a moderate approach, hopefully, to continued outperformance. And I think that should serve other investors well, too. I tend not to deal well with hyperbole. And so I don't try to impart it on anything from an investment standpoint. I think there are puts and takes right now. We talked about valuation. And in the software space and the NASDAQ in particular, we talked about maybe some people feeling there's a disconnect between the stock markets and the fundamental underlying Main Street economy. These things ebb and flow over time. And I think if you, there's some PMs on our team, you know, I would highlight Hugo Lavallee as being one of them. We just drill it down to securities, like really fine, and then invest where we have a lot more pros than cons. And we make really wise investments in that realm. And then that kind of diffuses all the emotion in investing, because you've really boiled it down to its true fundamentals. You get really comfortable with the investment outlook. You have the investment outlook go over multiple years, and it keeps you moderate, and it keeps that kind of patience. You refer to patience, I think, prevents you from making bad mistakes, or as we call them in the shop, like rookie mistakes. It will work itself out. The market generally goes up over time. It generally tends to correct when sometimes you least expect it. You take advantage of those opportunities. When you think it's a little too frothy, take a little bit of money off the table. Sometimes you're wrong in doing that. Other times you're right. But if you're consistent in your approach and you're measured or moderate, you probably make a lot more money over time than not. So that's been my personal take over years.
View of something is hyperbole in terms of investment themes, cryptocurrencies. We only have a minute, so just cram the cryptocurrencies into a minute. But I'm curious where that falls.
I think the technology behind some cryptocurrencies, so blockchain, for example, or other technology, is useful. And I think the development and the expansion of use of that technology is going to be really, really important as we go forward as a society. I think the concept of a cryptocurrency as we know it today, to me, is a little bit baffling, because I guess from all my training and education, the currency itself has to be backed by assets to fix it to some kind of FX, right? That can be tradable predictably over time and have a store of value. So we don't have that today. Maybe we'll have it in the future. So the idea of cryptocurrency is not a bad idea. It's a good idea. It should be kind of investigated. But the version that we have of it today, I think, is incomplete to really fulfill all the parameters and criteria of a true currency. But I think the topic should be further investigated, further researched, and further developed. Absolutely.
We kind of mentioned Canada as part of the ex-US discussion, but, you know, is Canada in a more difficult position than perhaps other developed countries around the world, or how do we measure up? Again, a couple of seconds here.
I'm bullish on Canada as a country. I don't think we're any, you know, more disadvantaged than any other. You use the phrase ex-US. I'm bullish on Canada. There's a lot I like about it. There's a lot I think that I've seen over the course of my career in business that we continue to grow exponentially in, from an innovation standpoint, an education standpoint, an immigration standpoint, that will all serve us well in future years and generations. So I'm bullish on that. I think what we do need to kind of continue to press forward on. I would like to see more advancement made on trying to keep Canadians in Canada, particularly those who are educated in Canada, to grow small businesses and small medium enterprises and feel that we have tremendous network externalities here, and then obviously those with the globe as well, but to build businesses. When I was, 25, 30 years ago, Kitchener-Waterloo did not look like it does today. And that's great, but I would love to see that even go faster. I would love to see other pockets of excellence develop in other fields, whether it's healthcare, finance, technology and software, or even hardware for that matter, future developments in agriculture where we can develop leading kind of bleeding edge scientific advancement, maybe in helping feed the world and aspects of this in agriculture. I think that's what I look forward to in Canada. I think we gotta do more on that front to keep talent here and then give them a fiscal and financial backdrop for businesses to excel. And hopefully, who knows, in years down the road, maybe Fidelity can play a role in that some way, shape, or form. I don't know.
Well, you've given us a positive look to the future. Thank you for helping us end off on that. Andrew Marchese, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Pamela. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.